I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Alan Marinus, the leader of the contemporary Musar movement. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Borel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. As we received news reports of Arctic cold weather conditions throughout America last week, it reminded me of the central truth that we are very much in God's hands a great deal of the time. This is a particularly appropriate reminder the week of the Jewish festival of Tu B'Shvat, the new year for trees that occurs in midwinter each year. This year it falls this Thursday, January 16th, a kind of Jewish Arbor Day on which we celebrate the growth of the natural world, the varying kinds of trees and the fruits they produce, and our own connection to the ecology of our world. It's very good to be reminded annually, at least, that we are very much dependent on the remarkable planet that God has given us, its times and tides, its weather patterns and ecosystems. By tradition, on Tu B'Shvat, the 15th day of the Hebrew calendar month of Shvat, we plant new trees and celebrate with a Seder, enjoying the progression of the seasons and the growth of the good earth that God created. That Tu B'Shvat Seder, the orderly meal in which the blessings we say and the food we eat both celebrate God's role in our lives and our responsibility for preserving and protecting the earth, is a lovely opportunity to recommit to our beloved planet. The more famous Seder on the Jewish calendar, of course, is the Pesach, Passover Seder in the spring that celebrates freedom. But the Tu B'Shvat Seder, invented by the mystics of the town of Tzfat in Israel, is a lovely additional way to connect with our heritage and with God. We could use some better Tu B'Shvat tunes, however. Here's a classic Israeli Tu B'Shvat melody, more for kids than adults perhaps, but cute nonetheless. That was Kach Holchim for the Tu B'Shvat Seder. Speaking of Seders, we've been talking about freedom a lot in the last few weeks, what with the Torah portions of the Exodus in our rotation. A couple of more thoughts on the subject. We live in a modern, fast-moving, connected world in which social media, radio and TV, and newspapers and magazines, and the internet all present a picture of an open, dynamic society of free-thinking, free-acting individuals. The important word here is free, and nowadays the technologies available to us lead us to believe that this world has never been more free. But last week's discussion of freedom here on Two Jewish generated a good deal of response, and one of the issues that's emerged comes from a statement I made that slavery continues to exist in the world today. Since I also spoke on the subject of freedom and commitment in a sermon from my pulpit last week, I've done some more research on the subject of slavery in the year 2014, or at least the year 2013, since that's the most recent data available. And what I've found is far more disturbing than even I suspected. While we generally think of slavery as a terrible institution that ended with the American Civil War 150 years ago, the truth is that all over the globe, many people are still enslaved in various ways. An organization called Walk Free has highlighted the problem through the creation of the Global Slavery Index. And it demonstrates that slavery exists in every region and is a serious problem from Haiti to sub-Saharan Africa to Yemen to Afghanistan to India to China to Thailand. While we Jews remember the great liberation from slavery depicted in the Torah, in which our ancestors were freed from Egypt, many people today are in some form or another of real-life servitude. Some of the numbers are staggering. According to this report, perhaps as many as 15 million people are held as slaves in India. There may be well over a billion people in India, but it's still a stunning thought. As many people as live in Switzerland and Austria combined are enslaved today in India. Much of sub-Saharan Africa has a slavery rate that can run as high as 1% of the total population. And in places as diverse as Haiti, Pakistan, Mauritania, and Moldova, slavery remains a serious endemic problem. I'm not yet sure what to do about this, to be honest, as I have only now become aware of the widespread prevalence of slavery in so many countries and issues involved with this blackening of human civilization. But before we take our own American freedom too much for granted, or claim that every government intrusion in our lives, you know, taxes or speed limits or health care, is some sort of slavery, we need to seriously address the issue of true human enslavement today. Obviously, no one who is a slave can live the life he or she would choose. It is a form of human restriction and perpetual torture that the world should not tolerate, officially or unofficially. I do suggest that you look up this website, walkfree.org, or the Global Slavery Index on Google. The information is eye-opening. And as the rabbi of a Jewish people who have celebrated human freedom throughout history, it is also a call to action. On that theme of freedom, and to play us in this morning, here's a song of the dream of liberation from the Jewish pop rock group Safam called Eliyahu, Elijah the Prophet.
I had a dream that I could change a world that was not free and turn a cry of anger into song. As time went by, the dream remained, but oh, how hard it proved to be. I knew I could not make it on my own.
That was the song Eliyahu by Safam. How do you make yourself into a better person? It's the question most often addressed in our society by New Year's resolutions or therapy. But Jewish tradition has a rich resource in this area that's been revived in recent years. It's called Musar, and the outstanding teacher and leader of that movement, Alan Marinus, will be our guest and explain how it works and why it works when we return on Too Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish This Morning Alan Moranis. He is the pioneer of bringing a remarkable and ancient discipline, Musar, having to do with character, self-improvement. We'll have him define it for you to a wide and very interested audience. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So the first question is, can you explain to the Two Jewish audience, what is Musar?
Well, Musar is an 1,100-year-old Jewish tradition of personal development, which is really a very practical way of bringing to life, bringing into people's lives, the injunction that the Torah gives to become holy. And that's a very lofty and very remote idea. How do I become holy? And in these 1,100 years, Jewish spiritual teachers in various countries, various times, have explored what is it for a human being to reach their potential, and that potential is to become as spiritually uplifted as the notion of holy would imply.
So, you know, Kedoshim to you, ki kadosh ani rechem, you should be holy because God is holy. Well, only if we knew the essence of God would that have practical implication, perhaps. What means does Musar, as they say in the Orthodox world, what means does Musar use to cultivate the development of a consciousness of holiness?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not really so much a consciousness of holiness as holiness itself. And that the notion that really underlies all of this is that each of us is already a holy soul. Each of us is made in the image and likeness of God. Each of us is a Ner Hashem, the candle of God. That there burns within us already as much holiness as we could ever hope or need or any possibility. We are holy beings, godly beings. The issue is that there are things that obstruct that holiness from shining brightly into our lives and through us into the world. And the practicality of Musar is focused not on becoming holy, but on removing the obstacles to the holiness that is already there, inherent in each of us.
Maybe in the second part of the show, we'll explore some of the similarities to Jewish mysticism, which deals with some, in a very different way, some aspects of that. When I was in rabbinical school, I remember talking to a wonderful teacher of mine, Rabbi Benzion Wacholder, and I talked about Musar, and he said, "Oh, Musar, that's what I grew up with. That. That's where you take a little notebook and you write down everything you did wrong that day." That's not exactly what it's about, but that is sometimes a stereotype of Musar in the traditional environment. Can you explore that a little bit?
Mm-hmm. One of the contemporary definitions of the word Musar is ethics. And ethics takes us into the world of right and wrong, good and bad. And in previous generations, there was a time when Musar would actually have been defined as rebuke or reproach or reproof, the idea of really correcting things that are wrong.
Based on that teaching in the Torah, if you love your neighbor, correct him right after.
Right.
Love your neighbor as yourself, reprove them.
And take responsibility for yourself.
Right.
And it can have, in the past, been a fairly harsh discipline. Rabbi Shlomo Wolbe, who was a great Musar teacher of the last generation, who died in 2005, he pointed out the difference, that in the pre-war generation, things could be done in a much more forceful and direct way. He attributes it to the fact that people then were stronger. I'm not sure about that. But the fact was, as he said, you could, if a student was in school, the teacher could hit the student.
Right.
That was an accepted form of discipline. Okay. He said, but in this generation, everything has to be done with love. That in our generation, you could hit a student or discipline someone or give them a very fierce reproach, but you would lose them in the long run because people aren't up for that in this generation. And he said, everything that is done in this generation has to be done with love. And so my own Musar teacher points out, he says, there are two kinds of gardeners. There's the kind of gardener who prunes, and there's the kind of gardener who fertilizes and waters. And he himself says about himself that he's a gardener who fertilizes and waters. And that kind of spiritual growth is the environment that I was trained in, and that seems, in my mind and my experience, to work for this generation. People need to be fostered. And that's a different approach to saying corrected.
We will talk much more with Alan Morenas about Musar when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it, is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country, the only place in the world certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. Word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akfel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. And now we welcome a favorite mystically recurring feature, our Zen Judaism moment, the Too Jewish Haikus for Jews. Beyond Valium, peace is knowing one's child is an internist. And is one Nobel Prize so much to ask from a child after all I've done? That was our Zen Judaism segment, two classic haikus for Jews. The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is set June 11th to June 23rd of this year, 2014. If you're interested in going with me on a fantastic pilgrimage journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to Jerusalem, please email twojewishradio18@gmail.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. We welcome our Mivina in Israel, our expert on Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
It's almost Chag Sameach.
Nachon.
It's time for the holiday of Tu Bishvat.
Mm-hmm.
Tu Bishvat, the new year for trees, one of the four new years described in the Mishnah.
Mm-hmm.
How do Israelis celebrate Tu Bishvat? How do we celebrate Tu Bishvat here?
So there's two things. We are eating fruits and then eating food.
And
then
and sometimes planting nuts too, you know, because
yeah,
they grow on trees.
Yeah, and planting trees. And we have actually, and we're planting trees because it's the only mitzvah that, it's not only, it's part of the mitzvah that you can do only in Israel, because you build the country. So from, you know, for the kids and the teens, everyone, like with the kindergartens and the school, the class, going planting trees in Israel. We're doing, like, I guess as well, like here, seder for Tu Bishvat.
A seder, right?
A seder.
So modeled on the Pesach seder.
But, yeah, without maror, no maror this
no
time.
No herbs, no unleavened bread, no lack of yeast.
Yeah.
And lots of fruits and nuts and ways of teaching about the connection. It's also
and wine. We have wine.
Of course.
White and red. I guess you know that.
And even rosé in between to work your way around to it. You know, one of the fascinating aspects about Tu B'Shvat that's become more important in recent years is its ecological emphasis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's really, talk about a green holiday. It's as green as a holiday can get. Mm-hmm. Has that developed more importance in Israel as well?
Yeah, actually, most of the seders and the events will combine recycling and, you know, thinking green, thinking how you buy less, use your things, you know, utilize the things that you are buying. And yeah, and actually also here in our Tu B'Shvat Seder January 16, we'll combine it with planting trees. But when, the one condition that we had that we will consider like the irrigation. So like also the trees that we will plant will be, there is a green thinking. Will you help
me? Yeah, like, of course. So they basically are designed to be the proper trees for this environment. They don't use too much
natives,
water. There's drip irrigation, native trees. Right.
So we will combine also here green and Tu B'Shvat.
You know, one of the beautiful aspects of Tu B'Shvat, and it really, it goes back to not only Mishnaic times, but particularly in Tzfat in Israel in the north, where they developed a lot of the traditions, is to remind ourselves how much we are dependent upon God for the goodness of the earth and the gift of the earth and how we should take care of it. A kind of a parallel question. Do you think Israel is becoming more green? Because really, used to not be so careful about such issues.
Yeah. Yeah, for 100%, Israel is more considered, more thinking about, you know, recycling. And I think we even have double responsibility for our, you know, our land. It's not just earth, but it's our land. After 2,000 of waiting, we need to, you know.
Really take care of it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. All right, well, Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach, Rabbi.
We'll talk next week. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, J-E-T-C-O, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. The state of Arizona allows its taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who then provide scholarships for kids from kindergarten through 12th grade to attend qualified private schools. JETCO helps provide a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get a 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Tax credit's not a deduction. Your taxes are reduced by the amount you give. Join over 750 supporters last year who donated money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. There's an additional tax credit now, the switcher credit, which increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,031 for single filers, $2,062 for married couples filing jointly. When we are fighting every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, we should all take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to help foster a Jewish identity for our community's children. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive the financial aid they need to receive a good Jewish education. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, call 520-647-8442, again 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of education.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And welcome back from a little jaunt, just a short one, kind of halfway around the world to the Far East.
Right.
You know the Jewish communities a little bit in Hong Kong and Singapore. People may not think of those as places Jews go, although rabbis know there are pulpits there occasionally that people take for a year or a sabbatical or something.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about those Jewish communities.
Happily. Just for the record, in case somebody knows me, I began this trip in Mendoza, Argentina.
Of course.
Which has a lovely Jewish community. Actually, the major car dealership there is Goldstein. And they have several synagogues. And although it's a relatively small town in Argentina, it's a very thriving Jewish community tied to the wine business and to the growing prosperity of that region of Argentina. I then flew across to Australia and visited several wine regions there, all of these first stops being connected with my wine job. And then I visited Singapore and Hong Kong. And I'll be happy to talk about whatever I know about the Jewish communities there.
Yeah,
which,
you know,
is,
that reminds me of the old joke about on with the tefillin, off with the tefillin. You know, here you've traveled pretty much the entire Circle Pacific route in many different time zones. But let's focus on the tail end of the British Empire, or Singapore and Hong Kong in particular.
So those Jewish communities actually got their start when those were British trading outposts. And among the earliest Jews there were wealthy Jewish trading families from Baghdad,
like
the Kadouris, and the Sassoons, etc. So in some ways, with the typical American mistake, we think of those communities as being Sephardic. They're not. They have nothing to do with Spain. They are Edot HaMizrach. They're sort of Eastern Jews originally. And then both Singapore and Hong Kong were supplemented by the arrival of Ashkenazic Jews, starting with the really big pogroms in Russia in the 1880s and accelerating in the 20th century with more pogroms in Russia and then ultimately the Holocaust. So that in Singapore and Hong Kong now, you have a few of the original trading families, merchant families from the old British days. You have far more refugees from really the tail end of the 19th century and the early 20th century in Eastern Europe. And now, because both those cities are major financial centers and centers of international business, you also have young families from Western Europe and North America who are expats assigned there to multinational corporations for 2 years or 5 years and who choose to affiliate with a synagogue, be it Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, whatever. There's a fair choice. I think you might recall that once I showed you a very funny picture that I took on the bulletin board of the synagogue in Singapore, which advertised Pesach in Phuket. The Marriott in Phuket made like kosher le Pesach resort facilities available and offered seders, and there was an all-inclusive package for the Jews from Singapore to go spend Pesach in Phuket the way Jews here go to Miami for Pesach.
Or actually Scottsdale for that matter.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you can do
that.
Did
not know that. Okay.
Well, interesting kind of slice of Jewish life, and I understand lots of expatriate Israelis also now doing business in those cities too.
Right. Although the Israelis and the Jewish communities often don't mix. They stay very much to themselves, but that's true. There are Israelis there as well.
Imagine that. Jews busy not getting along in community. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. As soon as Shabbat services end, little Benji walks up to Rabbi Bloom and says, "When I grow up, Rabbi, I'm going to give you lots of money." Rabbi Bloom laughs and says, "That's really good to know, Benji, but why do you want to do that?" And Benji replies, "Because my dad says you're the poorest rabbi we've ever had." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Can you recite the Ten Commandments by heart? I suspect not. Most of us can't. We usually remember, "Thou shalt not murder," and misstate it as, "Thou shalt not kill," or, "Thou shalt not steal," which we do remember. most people kind of recall there's something in there about honoring dad and mom and not swearing. Others might get the adultery part, perhaps even the Sabbath. Few people remember all 10 commandments. But whether we know them by heart or not, these 10 statements from this week's portion of Yitro are supposed to be the only words God ever spoke directly to our people. And yet, they are not really at the heart of our Judaism today. Why not? In point of fact, we Reform Jews have trouble with many of the 10 and struggle to find relevant ways to observe them. Nearly every commandment brings with it a problem, even the most positively phrased. What does it mean to remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy if we spend most of Shabbat working or shopping? I recall attending the URJ Biennial Convention in Toronto a few years ago and hearing Rabbi Eric Yaffe, then the president, thank the delegates at services for celebrating a non-wired Shabbat, free of iPhones and Blackberries. His remarks were immediately posted on Facebook and tweeted by many of the delegates using the same smartphones they were supposed to have put away for the Shabbat, the Sabbath. Nearly all commandments have complications. How are we to suitably honor our fathers and mothers if they are challenging people or even abusive? Not murdering or stealing seems clear, but how can we possibly avoid being jealous of our neighbor's better job or nicer car? And don't we take God's name in vain all the time without apparent repercussions? But I believe the commandment we have the greatest difficulty observing for Reform, Liberal, Conservative, Reconstructionist, Progressive, and all the other non-Orthodox Jews is actually the first one. It's the simple statement that there is a God who commands us at all. Classically, this first statement, which contains no apparent commandments to fulfill, has been considered by Christians to be a kind of preamble to the Ten Commandments. But we Jews have always insisted on understanding it as a unique and critical statement in its own right. Why? It's because, as logical as the Aseret HaDibrot may seem as a declaration of ethics, if we do not accept the existence of a mitzvah, a commander, they essentially lose their power. With no mitzvah, no commander, there is no mitzuveh, no recipient of the command. In practical terms, then, no real mitzvot, no commandments to keep at all. In philosophical terms, the warrant for the authority of the Ten Commandments is in this simple statement. God exists, God acts, God commands. It's why they are not called the Ten Suggestions, or the Ten Polite Recommendations, or the 10 nice ideas if you can manage them. It's only when we accept the existence of God, when we diminish our own elaborate sense of self, that we are able to partner with God to create a moral world. Only when we engage with the commander do we find the commandments. It's up to us, on this week of Parshat Yitro, to find for ourselves the one who commanded them, however we conceive of the Holy One, and to accept our role as recipients of ethical commandment. When we choose to do so, we will find that then we can be moral beings. We can shape this world in good ways. We can observe the Ten Commandments just as they were intended to be observed by heart. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Alan Marinus, the leading teacher of contemporary Musar, will explain just how this simple but deep practice can change you and potentially your life for the better. Find out just how when we return on To Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Aseinu, Aseinu,
An estimated 10,000 African migrant workers seeking asylum protested in the Rose Park across from the Knesset in Jerusalem last week. It was part of a nationwide migrant worker strike in Israel. A new law in Israel has allowed the police to detain illegal migrants in camps pending repatriation, and about 300 migrants have been held in these facilities in the 3 weeks since the law passed. Meretz member of Knesset Michael Rosin and two other Knesset members of other parties met with representatives of the migrants, but the Knesset as a whole refused to officially meet with them. Rosin called on other members of the Knesset to join the dialogue with African protesters. The asylum seekers called on the prime minister to hear them out, she said. A government at peace with its policies would respond in kind. But since this is not the case, and we have called on Knesset members to come to a meeting and talk with these representatives, listen to their problems, ask questions, and get answers. They are human beings, and it is high time the government treats them that way. The demonstration in Jerusalem followed protests in Tel Aviv, with thousands marching from Levinsky Park in South Tel Aviv to Rabin Square and the embassies of the U.S. and other countries, while refusing to report for work. There are about 60,000 African migrants in Israel now, mostly from Eritrea and the Sudan. While this is a minuscule number compared to immigration and refugee problems in America, or in Turkey or Jordan in the wake of the Syrian civil war, it is a particular challenge to a nation like Israel, created by immigration and sensitive to the needs of true refugees. In other news, the boycott and divestment movement continues to present challenges to Israel. Last week, the Netherlands' largest pension fund management company decided to withdraw all of its investments from Israel's five largest banks because they have branches in the West Bank or are involved in financing construction in the settlements. PGGM's investments in Israeli banks amount to only a few tens of millions of euros, not a lot, but its decision is liable to damage the bank's image and could lead other businesses in Europe to follow suit. Over the past few months, the Dutch pension giant contacted Bank Hapoalim, Bank Leumi, Bank Mizrahi Tfachot, the First International Bank of Israel, and Israel Discount Bank, and informed them all that their ties in the settlements and companies involved in building in the settlements created a problem from the standpoint of international law. The Dutch company told the banks that this was based on an advisory opinion issued by the International Court of Justice in The Hague back in 2004, which said that settlements in occupied Palestinian territories are illegal and violate Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. It states the occupying power shall not deport or transfer parts of its own civilian population into the territory it occupies. The Israeli banks responded that Israeli law doesn't allow them to cease providing services to entities connected to the settlements, nor would it even really be feasible. Last week, PGGM informed the banks that since it hadn't managed to alter their involvement in the settlements, and since no change in the situation seemed likely, it decided to divest. The decision took effect January 1st. PGGM is the Netherlands' largest pension management company and one of the leading such companies in the world, with some 150 billion euros of pension money under management. It concluded that it would be impossible to create a firewall between its investments in Israeli banks and the bank's activities in the territories. In fact, over the past few weeks, Dutch firms have engaged in a wave of boycotts, divestments, and sanctions against Israeli firms. Last month, the Dutch water company Vitens announced it was suspending cooperation with Israel's national water company Mekorot, given the latter's operations in West Bank settlements. A few weeks earlier, another Dutch company canceled a contract to build a sewage treatment plant that it had signed with Jerusalem's water company HaGihon because the plant was located over the Green Line. Officials in Jerusalem believe the background to this recent wave of boycotts is a new policy adopted by the Dutch government, under which it encourages commercial enterprises to avoid any business dealings with the settlements. But in PGGM's case, the pension company decided to boycott even Israeli banks with only indirect ties to the settlements. In other Middle East news, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has asked the kings of Jordan and Saudi Arabia to support Palestinian recognition of Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people. Kerry is also meeting with Arab League foreign ministers in Paris and hoping to hear a positive approach to this idea from them. Last week, Kerry met with King Abdullah of Jordan in Amman and King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia in Riyadh to brief both monarchs on his efforts to draft an Israeli-Palestinian framework agreement that would lay down principles for solving all the core issues of the conflict and provide a basis for continued Israeli-Palestinian talks. One of the key issues he discussed with both men was Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's demand for recognition of Israel as the nation-state of the Jewish people. Kerry has adopted Netanyahu's position on this issue. He's interested in including recognition in his proposed framework agreement. He's become convinced that without Palestinian recognition of Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people, he will find it impossible to get Netanyahu either to agree to conduct negotiations on the basis of the 1967 pre-Six-Day War lines or to demonstrate flexibility on the issue of security arrangements. But Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas has told Kerry he won't accept such provision, arguing that it would undermine the rights of Israel's Arab citizens, whom he really doesn't represent. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish Alan Marinas. He is the Musar teacher for this generation. I think it would be fair to say Musar was not well known, and certainly liberal Judaism, until quite recently. And in the last perhaps half dozen years, it's become common and quite beautiful to see Musar groups, Musar study groups, or other approaches to involving themselves in Musar developing around the country, around not just this country. Can you explain why it seems to be touching a chord today?
I think we have to understand the environment that it's coming into, which if you look at the Jewish world in the latter half of the 20th century, what you see basically is a Jewish world that had no place on its agenda for the inner life of the individual. Everything was really devoted to the community and the collective. That was true in ritual. I went to, as a kid, a Reform temple where the main form of ritual was either coming directly from the rabbi at the congregation or it was responsive reading. But yeah, it was all collective. There was no sense that each individual was unique. Each individual had their own personal spiritual destiny. Each person had their own path they needed to walk. Nothing addressing the individual. And so Judaism became more concerned with the building that was being built than the prayer that went on within that building. And it was all just about the outer of tikkun olam, the outer of the building, the outer of the community, of the federation, and so on, which is all wonderful, except it's only half the picture, because we have an outer world, but we also have an inner world. And in fact, our interactions with the outer world are determined by our inner world. If you're a person who has a great deal of anger in yourself, that's going to be how you interact with the world. If you're a person who's stingy or generous or trusting or worried, that will be the basis for interacting with that outer world, and that comes out of the inner world. But the inner world was completely neglected. And when you look at some of these features of the Jewish world that's been built in these 60 years, it has reflected that emptiness. And that has made people quite hungry, because they recognize that the rates of intermarriage, the rates of disaffiliation, the rates of disaffection with the Jewish world can be correlated to the fact that the Jewish world has ignored the personal life of the individual. But that's not historically true, because we've got these spiritual traditions that simply were not being made available. So we find a very typical situation of a desert and a glass of water. That if you're in a desert and someone offers you a glass of water, that looks pretty good. So there's nothing new about Musar. It's an old Jewish tradition. It hadn't been made available to people because the inner life was not being made available. Guidance for the inner life was not of concern. Now that that's happening, now that people are realizing that the Jewish world needs to attend to the uniqueness of everybody's spiritual journey, not just the collective, then people have been going looking into our own traditions to find out what our traditions have to offer in that context.
You know, I remember already I was a rabbi and standing in a group of other clergy, and they said, "Rabbi, will you offer a prayer?" And for them, it was the most natural thing in the world to pour out their hearts in sort of a spontaneous kind of prayer. That was the first time I'd ever been asked to do that, aloud, or I think privately, to be honest. And I was already a Reform rabbi and had come from a conservative background too, so I know it wasn't there either. Is there something wrong with the way we think about contemporary Jewish practice that we don't encourage this in a broader way? As long as we're being self-introspective as part of a Musar approach?
No, I think that we are subject to North American culture. And North American culture is very materially oriented, it's very technological, it's very rational, it's very scientific, it's very hard-headed. That's all good. But that's not how human beings are put together. We have heads and we have hearts. If we only pay attention to the head, then we end up as empty human beings. We're missing the whole point. We don't make the major decisions in our lives rationally. We don't decide who we're going to marry, who we're going to go into a relationship with, how we're going to raise our children. We don't make checklists and create all kinds of rational systems to decide on that. We live from the heart. But the culture is oriented towards the head. And so we end up with a mismatch and a dissatisfaction and a distortion. So there's nothing wrong with it. It's just only missing a big piece, because I certainly wouldn't want us to be an irrational culture.
Now, we have some of those around the world.
We do. But it's in the Jewish way to balance the heart and the head. And one of the great Mussar teachers of the last generation, Rabbi El Yalopian, who died in 1970, he described Mussar as making the heart understand what the mind knows. The mind can know an ideal, and Judaism is full of great ideals. The Torah is full of great ideals for how a human being should be. How do we implant that in the heart of the individual so it becomes second nature to that person, not just intellectual information?
One of the interesting aspects for me about Mussar, I've been teaching Zohar for a long time, and Kabbalah approaches it in a different way when it talks about Klipot and later Kabbalah especially. That is, there's coverings that cover our soul. How does Mussar understand the soul? You talked about that in a session I was privileged to hear. Can you explain that in sort of a concise way?
In a concise way, a very complex subject, probably the most complex subject about human beings, which is the soul. But the Jewish view is that, in essence, we are a soul. It's not that we are an identity that has a soul, I have a soul. That's not it. It's that you are a soul. A person is on a spiritual journey as a soul.
And so if a person is on a spiritual journey as a soul, and yet there are barriers, curtains, structures that prevent us from achieving what that journey can be, how does Mussar approach overcoming those barriers, if you will?
So the Mussar view, very traditional Jewish view, is that there are different dimensions of the soul. The very spiritual essence is the neshama, the real core where the light of God shines in each of us, but that there are additional levels of the soul as well, and one of them is called the nefesh, and in that level of the soul we find all the traits of character. And the basic Mussar view is that each trait of character, be it worry or joy or sorrow or trust or, and they're all the different inner experiences, each one of them which tends towards an extreme, and it doesn't matter which extreme, it could be extreme impatience or it could be extreme procrastination. Okay. Each of those is an obstacle or a barrier to the light of holiness shining through. So the practical work of spiritual growth is to know which of those traits you're challenged in by being in the extreme in one side or another, and then doing the work of transformation, actually changing yourself so that you lift that veil. And the impatient person becomes patient, that's a step towards holiness. The miser who becomes generous has taken a step towards holiness. It's not just self-improvement, it's actually a work towards transformation. And in the Jewish text, we read, tzaddik ketamar yifrash, that a tzaddik, a righteous person, like a palm tree, will blossom, not just get better. Blossom. The whole soul has the potential, like a flower, to blossom. And the steps towards that are the incremental steps of working on inner traits.
One of the fascinating aspects of Mussar is that it's not that there are angry people and happy people, that, you know, people have only some aspects, but that everybody is really on that continuum in a variety of different areas. Can you talk about those midot, those characteristics a little bit?
For the last 4 years, I've been surveying audiences saying, okay, who here hasn't been angry, never been angry? Who here has never done a generous thing? And it's funny, like, no one ever puts up their hands. And it's a little exercise that demonstrates what the Mussar teachers recognized over the 1,000 years that they were developing this tradition, which is that we all have all the traits, and each trait has the possibility of being positive or negative. And I will say to an audience, as I did in the session that you attended, I said, is patience a virtue? And immediately people say yes. And then I say, always? And there's a pause, and people say no. And they recognize instantly that you can be too patient. You can do harm with generosity. There is a positive side of envy. etc. And people get it right away, but they haven't thought about it. Well, in the 1,000 years that the Musar tradition was being developed, they did think about it, and they realized we have all the traits. The issue is never the trait itself. Anger has a positive quality. Anger is a signal. Something is wrong. How you respond to it becomes a matter of your spiritual wisdom. But the signal itself, the emotion itself, has only, it's only an experience. The what makes it positive or negative is the measure of the trait, whether it's in an extreme or not in an extreme. And that indicates that the spiritual curriculum of each individual is quite unique.
You know, I think about Maimonides finding balance and seeking balance in ethics. Not a surprise for a guy who was encountering Greek philosophy and they invented the concept of the golden mean. Is that sort of what Musar is getting at, or is that too simplistic?
It's too simplistic, but it's not off the mark. Like a lot of things, as I said earlier, we're dealing with the soul. We're dealing with a very complex reality. And it's good to simplify it because it's the way you enter it and don't find it an alien concept. As you get more into it, you find the nuances and the subtleties that go with that. But it is really clear that a person who is consistently impatient with other people is going to find that that's an obstacle to their spiritual growth. They will also be impatient with themselves, and they will be impatient with God, and they will be living a life in which, as the Musar teachers teach us, the thing about impatience is largely egotistical. It's about me and my agenda, and that will affect your spiritual life. So you have to recognize the truth of it. If Maimonides was being influenced by Greek philosophy, the previous generation, where Musar teachers were also active, were being influenced by Sufism in Muslim Spain.
Sure.
And they were hearing similar kinds of things across the board and pulling them out of the Torah as well.
Likely Maimonides also was influenced.
Correct. What language were these guys writing in? They were writing in Arabic.
Right, exactly.
So it's, you know, people were looking and saying, what makes a holy life?
Yeah.
And if they were learning it from Aristotle, or they were learning it from the Sufis, or they were learning it from the Torah, or they're learning from life experience, or their own teacher, or their wife or husband, that there really is a truth to it. And that emis, that truth, is really the essential thing. And the teachings that got handed down is not just because it's a teaching of Maimonides. It's because the teaching of Maimonides contained a truth which has resonated through the generations and to the individuals through the generations, which says that the extremes of the traits are spiritual obstacles to becoming the holy being that you have the potential to be. Most of us have the inclination to be, and the Torah says we have the obligation to be.
So if someone wants to approach improving their soul, I don't know if that's the right term even, or the right phrase, what's the best way to begin?
There was a great Musar teacher in the 19th century, Rabbi Nosson Zvi Finkel, and he said, don't get better, get higher.
Hmm.
If you get higher, you'll get better. If you just work at getting better, you'll get frustrated. So it's that's where it becomes spiritual, as opposed to mere ethical development. If you say to a person, okay, we're going to help you become more patient, or we're going to help you make right decisions, you're working at a very low plane. And it becomes frustrating because there's no elevation involved. And you know how it is that when you go up a mountain and you get higher, your perspective changes and you see the whole field differently. That's how you get better too. And there are two answers to your question. One is, the most practical one is, pay attention to your experience and learn from it. And the Musar teachers make a big point of that. And Rabbi Shlomo Wolbe, who I talked about earlier, his key teaching was hitlamdut, or hislamdus, teaching yourself from life experience. So the second way that you can work on things usually relates to the fact that most of us need a lot of help and support, especially if we're going to be learning something that has been developed over a long period of time. We can take advantage of the wisdom that's come before, and that's why I have created the Musar Institute, and we offer courses, and I write books, and so on. And I would say the simplest thing is to take advantage of the resources that have been developed over the last dozen years, and that would be a matter of going to our website, which is musarinstitute.org.
We better spell that.
M-U-S-S-A-R Institute.org.
M-U-S-S-A-R Institute.org. Musar.org. Musarinstitute.org,
right,
to get more information about this. I have to tell you a quick story before we finish. I was called as an expert witness about someone who was trying to improve their control of their temper. They were in danger of losing their professional standing, and I had to go before a judge as an expert witness, and I explained what I understood Mussar to be and how it was about self-improvement and character and midot, and explained the terms. And I finished after about 30 minutes, and the judge said, "Well, so you're talking about Mussar." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Oh, well, this guy lived in Israel in 1973 to 1974, and I was out of kibbutz, and they were teaching Mussar." You could have knocked me over with a
You
feather.
Just did so, knock me over with that story.
That's my favorite Mussar
that's
story.
That's incredible
you
story.
You just never know when it's going to turn up. I want to thank Alan Runnis for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Again, that's MussarInstitute.org for more information, or go to a synagogue near you and ask if they can help with Mussar.
Thank you so very much. Alan. Thank you. Pleasure.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll get a final musical play out and hear about next week's guest.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Rabbi Joshua Weinberg, president of the Association of Reform Zionists of America. Our play out this morning comes for Tu Bishvat, the holiday coming up this week, a beautiful improvisation on piano by Asaf Shelig on the music of Kahol Chim, the Israeli kids' song for Tu Bishvat. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.